This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black Left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, the Democrats try to gang up on the socialist on the Seattle City Council. The U.S. anti-war movement holds a national conference next month in New Jersey. And if charter schools are such a good idea, why are there so few of them in the white suburbs? But first, the nation's best-known political prisoner, Mumia Abu-Jamal, has been released from a hospital in Pottsville, Pennsylvania, and sent back to prison. The medical emergency began with a skin rash, according to Pam Africa of International Family and Friends of Mumia Abu-Jamal.
His skin was burning as if he was on fire. From his head to his toe, this rash had broke out all around his back. Mumia said there was not a crack or cranny that, you know, he didn't have, you know, this rash and this terrible itch. He wasn't able to sleep. He winds up in a prison infirmary and all for 2 weeks, and all which he was supposed to monitor. They took his blood and everything. Then, you know, people noticed that Mumia was beginning to lose weight, and he was still looking rather weak. What they gave him was, at this particular point, a water pill to bring the flush the poisons out, and they gave him some kind of cream to put on his skin, which soothed it for a matter of, you know, a few minutes, and then the itch was back. The burn was still there. He had lost so much weight, he passed out, and they rushed him to the hospital. When they rushed him to the hospital, Mumia's blood level, his sugar levels, was 779. A few more degrees, he would have been into a diabetic coma. Well, we also found out that his potassium levels was 178. To my understanding, that was a very high, dangerous thing there. And between the two of them, he could have been dead. When he got to the hospital, we had to battle in order to get his family in. And, you know, all power to the people and all, because the pressure of the people, we were able to get. They took Mumia to the hospital on Monday. Tuesday, we had his brother and his wife, Wadia Jamal, inside the hospital that was on the outside. We did a 24-hour vigil, and ICU refused to move. They said that his levels were 779 when he came in. By that day, they had it down to 333, and they were saying that a normal blood sugar count should be 100 or less. Then we found out that the hospital that they had Mumia in, they only had general practitioners. There was no one there to deal with his diabetes, and there was no one there to deal with all the other illnesses or the side effects from the poison that they put in. When I last seen Mumia was in the prison, and this was the day before he went to the hospital, 2 days before, Mumia's skin looked like smooth black leather. Very tight, and you know, and that's the way it was on his legs, and you know, on the back of his neck. When I rubbed his back, I could feel that it felt the exact same way. When his brother and wife saw him, the skin looked like, they described it as elephant-looking skin, and you know, and he had also lost 8 pounds. And the availability of visiting Mumia the following day, was able to get his brother. Another one, his brother, Billy Cook, and his son, Jamal, you know, and the hospital told us right after that he will not be able to have any more visits. Mumia could not sit. They had him handcuffed to a chair. His breathing was, you know, he couldn't breathe good. And, you know, he couldn't, his wife said, he went to give him a kiss. He was sitting there chilling with a film. She said he could barely move his head. And also she said he, you know, moved over towards him. His coherency is, you know, not really the same because he's weakened by whatever medications and things that he's doing. One thing we do know, that he needs these, you know, specialists. And there were so many people calling and putting pressure on the hospital, they moved him back to Mahanoy. And this is the prison that made him sick in the first place. And they're truly not adequate to deal with this situation here. They told us that there will be no visits on Mumia until next week. Again, people's pressure forced them to give up a meeting on Friday and on Good Friday, where they allowed five people, and they brought Mumia down into the visiting room. And I'm saying, and that was a hateful, spiteful move that they did then, because there's no way in the conditions they reeled him in. He couldn't hold his head up. His breathing still isn't that good. And he had to sign a document, and he couldn't hold the pen good. When these people said they wanted to silence Mumia, this is exactly what they're doing, because he can't speak, you know, to the point that you will understand. He can't write.
And what demand should we on the outside be making on behalf of Mumia?
We're demanding that outside doctor specialists be allowed to go in and see Mumia, specialists of his choosing. I want to point out that Minister Louis Farrakhan, upon finding out about Mumia's health, he said to the family, he told me to let the family know that he will pay for any doctor that they have of their choosing to go into that prison and to deal with the issue of Mumia. We cannot allow him to kill him. He said, because there are some doctors from California that's working, trying to get in there, and they're pulling together a legal team. But so far, nothing is really moving. So we are urging people to call the prison and Mr. Wexler. And we demonstrated there on Friday. We're going back on Monday, because we'd be damned if we're going to sit by and allow them to kill Mumia with everybody's hands tied. We're working on filing a federal habeas corpus suit, you know, right now. And there's a lot of things that's being moved on. We're also going to the district attorney's office and as the citizen arrest kind of thing, and a citizen complaint that, you know, they're trying to force us to sit back and watch them kill Mumia. His health for the last 3 months has been deteriorating more and more and more. And we want people to understand. Maureen Faulkner and Officer Faulkner's wife, who somebody killed her husband, and it's clear it wasn't Mumia, she said that she was pissed, she was mad, because for over 30 years she forced to have Mumia murdered through illegal injection. She said that now she will get her justice when Mumia go into that prison. And she said it will not be nice. And I'm saying, look, it's not nice what's happening to him right now. He is being terrorized, and it's torture. Can you imagine your body burning from head to toe, your skin erupting, and you're blown up to the point that your skin starts busting open? Sister Johanna Fernandez from the campaign to bring Mumia home, Rachel Wolkenstein, a former attorney of his, Michael Africa, and a brother by the name of Abdul John, they all went in to visit Mumia, and they allowed him to talk. The prison gave him 1 hour in the visiting room, not in the infirmary, 1 hour. And within that hour, they seen that, you know, people came out crying. The people in the visiting room were so upset. A lot of the people in there, you know, Mumia, what can we do? So, you know, people, what you can do is put pressure on your congressmen. These people is trying to make us sit down and watch a murder take place to satisfy the Fraternal Order Police and Maureen Faulkner. Call the prison. That's the pressure there. And what we're doing, we're filing charges at the district attorney's office and attempted murder that we're being forced to watch, and with documentation. Just stay in contact with us. Glenn, you'll give them the phone numbers. Let's do for Mumia what Mumia has been doing for us all these years, why they want to silence the voice of the voiceless.
Supporters of Mumia Abu-Jamal are urged to call the superintendent of the state prison at Frackville, Pennsylvania, to demand that Abu-Jamal get outside medical attention. That number is 570-773-2158. 2 years ago, Kashama Sawant of the Socialist Alternative Party won election to the City Council in Seattle, Washington, on a platform to pass a $15 an hour minimum wage. Now, Sawant is running for re-election against a field of three Democrats. She says her party's openly socialist approach to electoral politics has changed the political discussion in America.
I would say that it's important, first of all, to take account of the big picture, dramatic shift that has happened in Seattle politics and how that has rippled through across the cities of the U.S. and also has had an impact on international consciousness. The fact that an open socialist got elected to city council, defeating a powerful 16-year Democratic Party incumbent in a city that is dominated by the Democratic Party establishment itself, was something that shook everybody's consciousness. But after that, winning $15 an hour in a short period of time went further in confirming that this approach of genuinely grassroots left politics can work if we take it seriously, that is continued to be reaffirming. But beyond the $15 an hour, what we have demonstrated by having the city council office and using this bully pulpit in a truly political leadership kind of way, it's shown that if you want to have an impact on politics, you don't have to ascribe to this false dichotomy of inside versus outside strategy. And as a matter of fact, I think falling prey to that kind of dichotomy actually hampers the left in many ways, because it's not that simple. It's not inside versus outside. It's about what kind of principled approach do you use to politics and mass organizing? That's the real question. And so if we miss that fundamental question, I think we miss a lot of the opportunity, and we miss the real vision. And the vision that the left has to have at this moment is there's a huge opening in U.S. politics where the majority of Americans, the vast majority of Americans, many of whom aren't necessarily tuned to politics in any kind of wonky way, but are recognizing just from the day-to-day realities of their life that this is not working for us. So what we have done is, you know, use that principled approach, use the bully pulpit to win actual victories. Aside from 15, we made a huge mark on Seattle's budget. The mayor sends down a budget to the city council, and the city council adds or subtracts and votes on the budget. And what we did was we pointed out to the people that, look, the mayor, you know, the leader of the city who could do anything that he wanted, has sent down a budget that does not include the meager funds that we need to make sure that homeless women have a shelter year-round. You know, many of these women are escaping domestic violence situations. So we, you know, my office, working together with housing activists and homeless advocates, we made sure that the few $100,000 that are necessary in order to make that possible are put in. And it's incredible how much these small amounts of money are quibbled over, because it challenges the corporate agenda. It's not so much about that amount of money. It's the fact that, oh, wow, you know, activists on the ground, people on the streets are feeling empowered by this. The other thing that the budget lacked was any kind of real support for homeless encampments, which is a growing problem in the city because of skyrocketing rent and, you know, because of the aftermath of the recession. So we made sure that we put in dollars in the budget to ensure that they are able to fund for basic services like porta potties or, you know, internet connections, you know, health services, that sort of thing. We also made sure that a potential attack on low-income housing from the Seattle Housing Authority was fended off, and we did that by using the bully pulpit. I mean, that victory, it was a phenomenal victory to save low-income housing, was not a legislative victory in the sense that there was no bill or ordinance that was passed, but the mere fact that I'm here in a leadership position with some power and I'm able to shift the political agenda itself is extremely emblematic of what the left needs to do. And so I use my position to empower the low-income tenants, many of them East African women, many of whom don't even speak English, but who are fired up to fight for their families. We built a powerful campaign when we beat back a real corporate program.
In terms of challenging the corporate agenda, how has your presence on the city council forced the Democrats to change their strategies?
Well, first of all, what we've done, and this is, again, you know, one of the fundamental points that we shouldn't miss for all the details, is that this city, like many other cities, you know, Chicago is another example, is not dominated by the Republican Party establishment or the right wing. This city has been, for a long time, a one-party city until socialist alternatives came on the scene. Seattle has been a one-party city. It's dominated by the Democratic Party establishment. It presides over a very progressive electorate. You know, people on the ground in Seattle are far more progressive than the Democratic Party establishment. But the reason the establishment, the political establishment, has been able to get away for decades by not solving some of the critical problems of the city, transit, housing, racial justice, you know, racially biased policing, all of this, the reason they have gotten away with not addressing all of this, even though all of these problems fall at their doorstep, is because they're the only game in town. You know, you feel, okay, Seattle is progressive, or what's more progressive than the Democratic Party? You know, let's elect these Democratic Party establishment politicians every 4 years, and that's the best we can do. And you can't call them out because there's nobody else to provide a counterexample. And so for years, the city government has been this little club of people who have regular lunches and meetings with the Chamber of Commerce, with the Downtown Business Association, with representatives of big corporations like Boeing, McDonald's, Starbucks, Amazon.com, and that's the Seattle business way. And here I come on the scene, and now suddenly they have a big spotlight on them. You know, they are called out every time they betray the interests of working families. They betray the interests of the most vulnerable and marginalized, and suddenly the most marginalized have a voice because we're putting them on the spot. They no longer have this excuse, well, this is the best we can do, trust us, we're the experts, trust me, this is the way I'm working out a compromise solution, this is the best we can get. That kind of logic is no longer acceptable, and that is a fundamental shift. And so they are having to change their game. The establishment is having to change its game, is that it sees itself forced to vote on progressive bills that we're putting forward, because for them to not do that exposes them for who they are. So they're forced to vote on these things. So what they're doing is trying their best through backroom kind of negotiations to water down everything that's put forward, and using seemingly progressive arguments. But, you know, that whole line starts to wear thin when working people feel empowered. So now the establishment is on an offensive against me. They're running 3 candidates against me. They're all Democratic Party people. And I've heard that there is PAC money gathering against me. And what they're using, though, is not substantive issues, because they can't critique our work on substantive issues. So it's all about, she's not a team player, she's not very nice. One of the most recent, and I think the most viable candidate of the opposition, said, you know, that she would speak through a telephone rather than a megaphone, which I see as an insult not towards me, but towards the fact that grassroots politics is oriented not towards powerful people, but people on the ground who don't otherwise have a voice. And rallies and protests are a critical component of engaging people who aren't otherwise engaged. And I'm proud of that. And I think a lot of the activists I'm working with are really proud of that.
And you were making reference to Pamela Banks, who's head of the Urban League in Seattle. But some Democratic politicians have endorsed you.
Yes, that is a very interesting and very positive development, because, you know, the fact that Democrats like Pramila Jayapal and Larry Gossett have endorsed my campaign for re-election shows you that many people who run as Democratic Party candidates, many people who don't run for office but consider themselves Democratic Party supporters, see their values aligned with what I stand for. And so for them, what's important is not whether I have a certain association with another organization, it's more, what do you fight for? Are you fighting for the interests that I stand for or not? And they answer that question with an affirmative, and they recognize that it is critical that we ensure this re-election, because there is a lot at stake for all of us.
Your party, the Socialist Alternative Party, got a real boost in terms of growth around your first victory. What kind of impact does it have on the grassroots organizing that your party does to have an office holder as the head of the party?
I think there is no question, absolutely, that Socialist Alternative has experienced a tremendous spurt of growth, and that it's not been just a one-off in the first few months after the inauguration. It's been an ongoing phenomenon that we're observing, and it's, you know, well beyond doubled in size nationally and in Seattle. And I think the point should be made is that what's attracting a lot of young people, a lot of indeed people of all ages from the left, from people who weren't politically active hitherto, but, you know, are now feel quite energized to be part of politics because of what we're doing. The point I'm making is that what's important is not only are they inspired that a grassroots campaign that took no money from corporations was able to succeed in a city that is completely dominated by an entrenched big business party, but also what we've demonstrated since taking office. I think they're seeing that the way to have accountable representative leadership is to have accountable elected officials, you know, where people who run for office commit to fighting for the agenda for working families, do not run because they have personal career interests. To have a candidate who says that I pledge to take only the average worker's salary and make that a reality, a candidate who says that I will not curry favor with corporations, and to see that in practice, you know, in live demonstration, I think that is what's inspiring to people. And more than anything else, what is riveting people's attention is that that kind of politics can have not only a significant impact on actual outcomes in people's living standards and in their lives, but also that it can completely shake things up in an electrifying manner. I mean, that is what we're saying. And I think that message is very important for us to propagate throughout the United States, because that is our only hope. You know, at this moment, there is a situation where both big business parties have completely lost the confidence of the American people, their approval ratings of Congress, all-time lows. When else, if not now, will the left, the labor movement, activist organizations all across the United States, when else will we see that we need to use this moment to build something really powerful?
And finally, in terms of money, how much is a raid against you in Seattle, dollar-wise? How much do you have to defend your office?
I have no idea how much the opposition is raising. I mean, I know that the individual candidates have raised a few tens of thousands of dollars. It's, you know, it's still early in the campaign, and we've raised about $40,000. And as I said, you know, no corporate donations, only from working families, from the labor movement. But I would say that even though I don't know the amount that the establishment is raising, we should expect tons of money to be raised and to be unleashed in the final days of the campaign. If not before, we should expect them to try and present sort of, you know, falsified scandals. We should expect all kinds of attacks. And I think it's a good moment to remind ourselves that a key component of consolidating our past successes through $15 an hour and, you know, all the other successes we have had, and to point the way forward, is to emphasize that just as the establishment is very clear about its agenda to, you know, remove our voice from City Hall, we also have to be clear that we have something at stake here, and we have to fight in a unified manner. So I've been very systematically making an outreach to the labor movement in Seattle, and I'm happy to inform you that we now have 13 unions that have endorsed our campaign, including really important and large representations, including the Boeing machinists, the building trades, and we're going to make sure that we speak with one voice, and we say that this is a voice for the labor movement, this is a voice for non-unionized workers, this is a voice for people of color, and we're going to make sure we prevail.
And how does that compare to the endorsements from unions in your first run?
Quite dramatically, actually. And I think that's a very important point, because one of the themes we feel needs to be emphasized is, and not just in theory, but in practice, is that for decades, the labor movement has invested millions of dollars, tens of millions of dollars, in Democratic Party establishment campaigns, unleashed hundreds of thousands of foot soldiers who get out the vote for Democratic candidates. And what do we have to show for it in terms of victories for labor? How much do we have to show for in terms of how well the candidates of the labor movement campaigned for stood with us? We are standing at this moment with a long history of betrayals to the labor movement. And I think it's important that we clarify this within the labor movement, that the logic of lesser evilism, we want to talk to everybody who brings that up because we understand where it comes from. But the problem with the logic of lesser evilism is that it's ad infinitum. So if we accept that, there is never going to be a logical point where we can say, at this moment, we have to make a clean break and we have to ensure that we build an independent movement, meaning a movement independent of the two big business parties, and that we reject the position of the Democratic Party establishment, which is sold to us on the basis that, well, you know, at least we are not the right wing. I think that that point needs to be made. And in fact, it goes further than that. The best way of defeating the attacks by the right wing on labor, on women's rights, on the environment, is to build a powerful left. That is the only way we can defeat the right wing. I mean, look at how many states have gone right to work. Right to work is coming to Washington State as well. And so for the labor movement in Seattle, after the capitulation of the Democrats in the state legislature on the Boeing deal, where they gave away $9 billion in a special, you know, executive session, and with right to work staring us in the face, I think it's urgent that the labor movement consolidate itself and say, you know, we have to make a clean break from this establishment that has forsaken us, and we have to build our own independent strength.
Yes, lesser evilism allows the Democrats to position themselves cosmetically just a little bit to the left of the Republicans and then keep drifting to the right at the same pace the Republicans do.
Absolutely. And I think an empowering way of looking at that problem also is to see how quickly the cracks in the Democratic Party establishment can appear, even with the initial beginnings of a challenge to them. You know, look at how Rahm Emanuel, who saw himself as completely invincible, spent $15 million on a mayoral race, got Barack Obama to come and campaign for him, and that did not buy him an outright victory. What it means is that when the Democratic Party goes on the rampage, the establishment goes on the rampage, and acts so clearly against the interests of black people, against the interests of labor, against the interests of teachers, people are going to get angry. Then that poses a question for the left. How are we going to harness that anger and disenchantment to build a real strength out of it, as opposed to simply being a force that is relegated to go on the defensive always and forced to react, as opposed to proactively grabbing the reins of leadership?
Kashama Sawant of the Socialist Alternative Party in Seattle, Washington. The WikiLeaks organization recently released more revelations about President Obama's Trans-Pacific Partnership Trade Treaty, or TPP. The treaty would decisively strengthen corporate power in the U.S. and the 11 other nations involved. President Obama wants Congress to give him so-called fast-track authority to pass TPP without debate. We spoke with Patrick Woodall, research director of Food and Water Watch. He says the treaty's being formulated in secret and would remain secret for 4 years even if the treaty is rejected by the Congress.
That's absolutely right. The text that was released was actually the most secret portion. It's the investment chapter, and it confirmed the worst of our fears. It includes language that grants powerful new avenues for corporations to attack basically common sense, public health, environmental, and consumer protections, all to protect their reasonable investment expectations. This is kind of code word for them to attack any rule or regulation or law or even a court decision which they feel has hindered their revenue stream, which really could be anything. And so not only can they sue, but they can sue for monetary damages. Already on trade deals that the U.S. has signed, there have been more than $3.5 billion awarded under these secret trade tribunals for these corporate lawsuits, what are called investor-to-state lawsuits. And they're a huge impact on our local democracy because it has a chilling effect on small communities and towns that might want to pass laws to protect their water or their air or their highway safety because they could face huge multi-million dollar challenges from transnational companies.
What is the meaning of the principle of self-determination if it can be trumped by a corporation's claim that its future profits might be somehow endangered?
Well, I think what it says is that according to the TPP negotiators and the companies that are advising them, the U.S. has 600-some companies that are allowed to help negotiate the text, whereas the rest of the public is completely in the dark. What it says is you can have democracy and self-determination as long as the companies agree it's okay. And that's just appalling.
The Obama administration always tries to position itself as safeguarding the rights of people against the imperatives of corporations, but this changes the rules of the game, giving further advantages to those corporations structurally in international law.
Absolutely. It's a huge expansion of corporate power, and it gives foreign companies an incredible leg up to use even the threat of these kind of lawsuits to deter local and state and federal government from taking any action. You know, we see this all the time on the federal level where things are considered to be trade illegal. And so even common sense things like labeling the country of origin of our food are constantly bottled up because of concerns that it might run afoul of international trade deals. But this allows the companies themselves to bring suits against the federal or state or local government. And, you know, with that kind of sword of Damocles hanging over local communities, it makes them more timid and less willing to protect their citizenry, less willing to enact the will of their constituents when they could face some multi-million-dollar lawsuit from some foreign company.
Yes, we keep on talking about foreign companies, but many of these companies are, in fact, U.S. corporations, and those lobbyists who are stacking the deck are largely American lobbyists.
Right. We've been talking so far about the impact on U.S. law and U.S. sovereignty, but obviously it goes several directions. First, these companies have, U.S. companies have subsidiaries everywhere, including in some of the TPP countries, which would allow their subsidiaries to bring a case against the U.S. or local governments. But also it means that U.S.-based companies could bring these kind of cases against people in Peru or Chile or Vietnam or Malaysia, where the governments are weaker and have less resources to defend against this. And obviously this is extremely perilous on things that are about natural resource extraction, where you have a mining or an oil company with a real interest in getting at those resources. And if some government decides that you can't pollute or you can't mine and destroy a local area or you aren't allowed to offshore drill or something, this could be a huge ability for U.S. companies to bring these suits against other countries.
And in fact, that's what happened to Ecuador under the existing international treaties.
Absolutely. I mean, these kinds of investor-to-state lawsuits are not uncommon, and the most common defendants are actually countries in the developing world where the kind of the mere threat of this kind of lawsuit will get governments to back down. And so this does happen, and obviously it's something we're super concerned about in terms of global equity and fairness. These trade deals are really tilted towards big business, and that's bad for U.S. workers and bad for U.S. communities, but it is occasionally apocalyptic for communities in the developing world that could face the drilling or the mining that is now enforced with these kind of unfair rules tilted towards corporations even further.
But the governments of U.S. cities and counties and even states aren't much more sophisticated or rich than third world countries.
I think obviously that's true, and you know, we have a kind of vibrant democracy movement on the local level all over the place. We work very hard to ensure that communities can protect themselves from fracking for natural gas, for example, and there have been 250 communities across the country that have passed bans or moratoriums on fracking, including New York State. But these kind of rules could be challenged at these international trade tribunals by foreign drilling companies. And in fact, under NAFTA, the province of Quebec in Canada has already been challenged for its moratorium, which Quebec is using to study the impact of fracking on the St. Lawrence River system. So it's a big deal. And it, when you talk about having these towns or counties or municipalities face a lawsuit from an international petroleum company, obviously it's very threatening, and it does deter local governments from standing up for their people.
And what is the rationale for classifying these negotiations and keeping these negotiations classified for 4 years, even if there is no treaty? Whose national security are we talking about being in jeopardy, if that's the rationale?
I think it does appear that what they're trying to protect is not the national security, but the kind of public perception that this is a giveaway to big business, which is exactly what it is. And so they don't want people to know what's in the text so that they can't dispute what's going on. And that's actually what's happening now. It's easy for the forces that are pushing for TPP, the big business community, Wall Street, the White House, the Republican leadership, to say that TPP is going to be fine and it isn't going to hurt us. But if all these things are true, why is it so secret? Why can't they just tell us what's in the negotiations? And so these are real legitimate questions. Why is it so difficult, even for members of Congress, to get access to the text?
So I guess the American people, whether they know it or not, owe a debt to Julian Assange.
I think the transparency that's been provided is incredibly useful. The reality is that we're not going to get it from the White House. And so as a consequence, being able to see some of these documents is incredibly helpful. It's vital that we be able to demonstrate that these risks are genuine. And it's easy for people to say that there's nothing dangerous inside the TPP when they hide it from the American people. So a leak like this is invaluable in demonstrating the real risks of this kind of trade deal.
That was Patrick Woodall of the Food and Water Watch. Supporters of charter schools claim they are educationally superior to conventional public schools and more responsive to the needs of parents and students. But if that's true, then why are the vast majority of charter schools located in mostly black inner cities rather than in the white suburbs? We pose that question to David Rutherford, a school board member in the majority black city of Plainfield, New Jersey. Rutherford says that in his city and elsewhere, charter schools are part of a racial pattern in which the state denies black and brown populations control of their own public schools.
Next year, there will be 5 charter schools in Union County, all of them in Plainfield. This is part of the larger context of New Jersey, majority black cities, majority black and brown cities as well. In Newark, New Jersey, our largest city, there's a state-appointed superintendent who is not beholden to the Board of Education and therefore not beholden to the people of Newark, the same in Camden. And there are other poorer, majority black cities that have state-appointed monitors that regularly overrule the board-hired superintendents. So there's a pattern in New Jersey and in the country of taking local control away from majority black and brown cities, like here in Plainfield. It's no different. 21 municipalities, all charter schools are right here in ours.
So taking away local control and installing charter schools seems to go hand in hand.
It does. Locally, as a Board of Education, we have no say on whether there will be charter schools in our city, how many there will be, who will run them. Absolutely no say. Our only obligation is to pay these charter schools per student, and that's about all we can do. Everything else is handled by the state. The state pulls the levers on what happens here in Plainfield. It does not happen in richer communities, and we can see this from here to California.
So charter schools are good enough for black folks, but apparently not good enough for white people.
Exactly. In fact, it really adds insult to injury. It's one thing not to have local control of your own school. That's becoming a greater trend here and around the country. But it's another thing when they let people come in that you know the community would not trust with their children. Right now, one of our newer charter schools that's opening, the College Achieve Central Jersey Charter School, it's run by a man named Mike Piscal, who is most known for running the Inner City Educational Foundation in California. Mr. Piscal has been featured 4 times in the LA Times for the wrong reasons. He had gross financial mismanagement of his school. Off the charts, really. That caused one Los Angeles blogger to say, if there was no malfeasance, it's just unconscionable the way he squandered so much money. In fact, as the founder of the ICBF, the Inner City Educational Foundation, Mr. Pascal had to resign himself. The only reason the foundation even lasted beyond him is because it was bailed out by these super rich financiers that believe in the charter movement. So this man, Mike Pascal, he went to Las Vegas, spent a year or so there, rather unclear, working for Andre Agassi, tennis star Andre Agassi's once troubled charter school network, and now he's here, and he fashions himself as an entrepreneur. So not only does Plainfield not have a voice in what's going on with its public dollars, which are spent on the charter schools, we can't even say who gets to bring them and who doesn't.
So it seems that black communities like Plainfield get the dregs of the charter school movement, or hustle, some might call it.
Exactly. You know, these people are not linked to any community. They move around. He calls himself an entrepreneur. It's rather brash that these people, they may have a nonprofit front. They may speak that language of caring about children, but they call themselves entrepreneurs, which is a lot different than people in the nonprofit sector or public servants and such. So we do get the drag.
And in fact, the charter school that is about to shut down in Plainfield is being terminated because of financial mismanagement.
Yes, Central Jersey Arts Charter School did not meet 4 or 6 financial standards. So we have a history here of failure due to a lack of fiscal responsibility. And just as one goes out, they let another one through the door.
Now, many of those who support charter schools say that they make sense, especially for poor communities, because they run them like a business. But this business model doesn't seem to have much to do with education at all, and sometimes doesn't even function in terms of business.
Certainly. That's really a game changer, the fact that they're trying to apply a business and competition model to public schooling, public finance education. The system now is that you can start a charter school, doesn't work out well, close down in 3 years. But this not only applies to charter schools. Public schools also can be shut down and reopened and replaced by a charter and such. So schools have always been a pillar of a community. You have your local library branch, perhaps. You have your local post office. You have your school. And to make the school something that you can move around and reposition, it really changes what public education is about, what it's always been about. And I'd argue that schools are the strongest of these local neighborhood pillars.
You seem to be saying that charter schools are a vector of community instability.
Exactly. They're certainly a vector of community instability. Sometimes they're damaged pillars, but they're locally controlled pillars that are beholden to the population. These charter schools are not.
Well, there's certainly no question that they're damaging to the stability of the teaching profession. Charters are, for the most part, non-union.
Exactly. And that applies both to corporate, national charter schools and local charter schools. All charter schools are non-union. And a lot of the leaders in the charter movement, these are the same people who support Teach for America, which operates under the belief that with a degree in architecture or law and very minimal training, anyone can be a teacher, or these folks can be a teacher. And in fact, you can teach on your way to your law career. And this is a ridiculous belief. Teaching is not easy. Effective teachers are professionals. And when we lower the professional standard for teachers, students, and American education will pay. I don't know anyone who denies that there are flaws in providing equal access to a quality education in America, but to imply that business model of the free market is the way to improving the educational, the K-12 educational system in America is ridiculous, because as we all know, if it were up to the free market, we would never have been allowed public education in the first place.
Well, certainly the charter school business model is a very good deal for these entrepreneurs. They get a cut of the public educational budget, but they also get subsidized in other ways by the public.
Certainly. And while much of the charter movement is ideological and these people believe in breaking down the unions and letting the free market reign everywhere, we shouldn't take our eyes away from the fact that there is actual profit to be made. In many states, New Jersey is one of them, it is not legal to operate a charter school with a for-profit organization. But many of these nonprofits devote large percentages of their operating budget, which of course is tax money. They funnel this money to these EMOs. These are educational management organizations. And in the U.S., 50% of charter school students are in an institution that's run by an EMO. These EMOs are 100% for-profit, and they can run small parts of a school, but more often than not, nowadays, are more and more starting to run the entire operation and skim profit off the top. Another place where there's a lot of money to be made is in the lending for school construction and other startup costs. There's always interest to be made with lending, but there are also tax credits, like the New Market Tax Credit, which is a 39% federal tax credit that is awarded to people who make investments in low-income communities. The contradiction here is that the community's own tax dollars are paying for this investment and are paying that interest. And they never got a say in whether their tax dollars would be used for this purpose. So these financiers are acting as the middleman and gobbling money up that way as well. And, of course, we have all the contracts, whether it's an EMO or otherwise, that are granted by charter schools. There's much less transparency in the granting of contracts with charters compared to public schools, which, in general, try to do as much as possible in-house as opposed to hiring large management companies.
Early on in the charter school experience, a significant portion of the black community welcomed the charter schools in the belief that anything was better than the public schools. But now we see significant evidence of buyer's remorse, don't we?
We certainly do. I think there have been enough examples of charter schools that perform worse, certainly not better than their public school counterparts. It's also worth mentioning that these charter schools very often have less special needs children compared to the overall district. They have less children on free and reduced lunch. The population served by these charter schools are relatively more privileged than the community at large, and we've seen that in New Jersey as well.
That was David Rutherford of the Plainfield, New Jersey Board of Education. UNAC, the United National Anti-War Coalition, holds its national conference on May 8th through 10th in Secaucus, New Jersey, just outside New York City. UNAC spokesman Joe Lombardo says the theme will be Stop the Wars at Home and Abroad.
UNAC, actually, when it was first founded, used that slogan, Stop the Wars at Home and Abroad. And originally we were thinking about it more in terms of the fact that the so-called war on terror had a domestic component, and we were seeing that very much in terms of the attacks that were going on with the Muslim community. But it became more and more clear as time went on that there's been militarization of the police force, more heavy-handed intervention into the black and Latino communities, more people deported, more austerity being handed down to the unions, more attacks on civil liberties. So this war has had a real impact on the people in the United States, and we've seen large movements in protest to the war at home, especially around the question of Black Lives Matter. So we want to make sure that this is an important theme and that we connect all these dots.
50 years or so ago, there was a real internationalist component to the black liberation movement here at home. Do you think we may be seeing some kind of consciousness like that developing today?
I hope there is. There's clear connections between what's going on at home and the attacks on Africa as such. There's a consciousness about the attacks on the black community in the United States and other parts of the world. Recently, I was in Moscow, for instance, with a group of people from UNAC, where our hosts in Moscow organized a demonstration which we participated in at the U.S. Embassy. It was around the question of the attacks on Eric Gardner and on Michael Brown and the whole question of the attacks on the black community in general. So even in that country, which has a very small, if much at all, black community, there's a consciousness of that, and we were able to build a protest there.
And we've seen much evidence and statements of solidarity from Palestinians to the people who are struggling in Ferguson and elsewhere in black America.
Yeah, that's very true. And there was also big Palestinian protests in the United States around the time of the attacks on Gaza. And when they started seeing what was happening with the militarization of the police and the attacks on the black community, it was very familiar to them because that's what happens in their daily lives in Palestine. And so they wrote messages of support, talked about how they dodge tear gas, for instance, and face some of the same situations that the black community was facing here in the United States. And I think that was a really important message of solidarity from two groups of people that are really struggling.
A portion of the forces that used to call themselves anti-war seem to have aligned themselves with the doctrine of humanitarian military intervention as promoted and practiced by Barack Obama.
You're right, and that's a real shame. In 2008, when Obama was elected, there were actually anti-war groups who thought, well, this means peace, and we're going to close up shop. Obama, at the time, never said he was going to end the wars. He always said there was a good war and a bad war. The good war, of course, was Afghanistan. The bad war is Iraq. And now we can see he's left neither of those countries, even though he said our military, the U.S. military, would. And there's been increased military action all over the world. Libya was an example of it, the attempts at regime change in Syria, what's going on in the Ukraine, and attacks on Russia at this time. And, of course, there was a huge increase in the use of drones all over the place, flying into countries that we're not even at war at and killing people at will. So there's really been an increase in the war and the wars that have been going on around the world since Obama has been elected. And yet a lot of the liberals and a lot of the old anti-war activists that were active under Bush stopped being active. And it's one of the reasons that UNAC was formed, because we understood that U.S. imperialism has not changed its stripes and we need to continue to have an anti-war movement, and that's what we're doing.
And now President Obama is seeking a open-ended mandate to attack ISIS, or whoever he considers ISIS to be, anywhere in the world.
Yeah, and it's really strange because in many, many ways, it's the U.S. and its allies and partners that have created ISIS. It's the whole atmosphere that destroyed the stability in that whole area of the world and the Middle East that created the atmosphere from which a group like ISIS could grow, and the sectarianism that the U.S. helped foster between Shia and Sunni Muslims. But it's also the U.S. allies like Saudi Arabia, who today is bombing Yemen, and Qatar and Jordan and others that have been supporting and arming ISIS. And now we're using that as an excuse. The United States is using that as an excuse to continue its bombing and to continue its military intervention into that whole part of the world. And so it's just a whole farce. And I really believe that war is totally endemic to the system that we have now, and there will be endless war unless we can stop it.
And as an imperial power and still a huge economic superpower, the United States can wage war by other than direct military means.
That's true. And one of the ways has been sanctioned. If you just look at the sanctions that the U.S. imposed on Iraq between the Gulf War and the Shock and Awe War, it killed 1.5 million people. According to UNICEF, 500,000 of them, half a million, were children. And U.S. officials have said publicly that they think it was worth it. It might have been worth it for them, but it wasn't worth it for those people and their families. And now we're imposing sanctions and using the oil market to try to put pressure on Russia around the Ukraine area, because the United States wants total control of the Ukraine as it tries to continue to surround Russia, and also as it continues to try to surround China with its pivot to Asia. So there's many ways that war is conducted, and these are some of them.
And the United States is sanctioning Venezuela, a country that has held more free and fair internationally recognized elections than any other country in the Western Hemisphere.
Yes, that's absolutely true. Partially also because Venezuela is a large oil producer and wants the benefit of that oil to go to the Venezuelan people, and the United States wants to see it privatized so U.S. capitalists can make profit off of that oil too. And so this is a problem, as well as the fact that there's a government in Venezuela that's different than the kind of government the United States wants to see, not one that just supports the wealthy, but supports the people. And that's a terrible example for the people that rule in this country. They don't want to see that kind of government anywhere in the world, so they're doing their best to stop it.
It's clear that the anti-war movement needs to regroup and reboot. What do you think will happen to affect that May 8th through 10th in New Jersey?
We are having an open conference where most of the anti-war leaders that have continued to struggle will be there, as well as leaders of many other struggles, because we think what's really important in the way we're really going to build a movement now is to connect those dots and join together with people that are fighting around questions of police brutality and fighting for rights of undocumented workers and fighting the wars overseas and fighting against austerity. So there'll be people from all of those struggles that will be there, and we hope to put together a common way forward for all of us, understanding the a very important part of that has to be the struggle against the wars that are continuing all around the world.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host, Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.
You've been listening to the Black Agenda Report on the Progressive Radio Network. Information for liberation. We'll be right back.